Okay, so since today we have an altered schedule, which I guess is a reflection of our connection to the world of the Umayyad Ha'ilam, so we'll talk a little bit about Umayyad Ha'ilam. In this week's parasha, we have Rivka coming to the Navi, and he tells her, Shnei Gaim Bevet Nechi Shnei Umim. There are two nations here. And one nation will prevail upon the other nation, will prevail over the other nation. The greater one, the older one, will end up serving the younger one. This expression that one nation will prevail over the other nation, the Gemara in Megillah says that this is really a formula for describing the whole future of world history. The pasuk elsewhere, the emla hachareva, the Gemara darshins that whenever one is up, the other one is down. From these two nations that are in your womb, whenever one is up, the other one is down. So this sounds like a nevuah that the balance of world history will be a struggle between Yaakov and Esau. Interestingly, there's a balaturim right at the beginning of the parasha.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So go now to over here. Here's the outline. Just that paragraph, and then come back to me. I'll get you back to that chapter. Okay. The parasha begins. Eil Tehillis Yitzchak. There's about Turim on the final words of last week's parasha, explaining the smichus between the end of Chayesar with the beginning of Teilis. Last week's parasha talked about Yishmael. Eilech shnei chay Yishmael. Ma'as shanu shlachim shanu v'shav v'shanu v'yigiv v'yamas v'yosef al-ama v'yishkir mechavila ad-shura al-shura p'nei mitzvayim v'yach ha-shura, describing how his offspring settled that whole area. Al-p'nei chol echav nafal. And Rashi says that the word nafal is a little bit of an unusual usage. The simple meaning of the pasuk seems to mean that he simply dwelt there, but it has this underlying meaning of expression of downfall. The Balaturim, says that the smichus of al pnei chalachav nafal with Eilat Hildes Yitzchak ben Avram, he says, with the downfall of Yishmael will come the salvation of the Hildes Yitzchak ben Avram. As if to say that the future of the world is in the struggle between these two brothers, Yishmael, the offspring of Yishmael with the offspring of Yitzchak. So it is this two, they're not saying the same thing. If you take a very general, approximate translation, and you know, just say, "Well, they're both talking about how Yidden against the Goyim," but it's different Goyim. One is about the brothers of the sons of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yishmael, and the other is about the sons of Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Esav. So these are two perspectives from the parasha. Yeah.
Can I repeat the pasuk?
Al pnei chol echav nafal.
That's
the final words of Parshas Chayesara, talking about the sons of Yishmael, and it says al pnei chol echav nafal, and then that's the end of Chayesara. Then begins Eil Tehillis Yitzchak. So the beginning really of any discussion about the Umayyad Ha'ilam is in the Nevuos in Daniel, where there are. Sikkim over there actually tells us about two different visions that depict four entities that are interpreted as being four Malchios. And there are many, many references in Chazal and in other, in Rishonim, in all Teredika references to the Arba Malchios. It originates again in those visions in Daniel. There's two. There's in Perek Beis of Daniel, there's a dream of Nebuchadnezzar, which is interpreted by Daniel as referring to Arba Malchios. And then later on in the Sefer, Daniel himself has a vision of four Chayos that are interpreted to refer to the four Malchios. So, and those four Malchios are understood to be four different nations that played some sort of an important role, a prominent role in world history. Now, the first three are pretty widely accepted what they are. The first one is Babel. That's clear from the context. It was Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babel. Nebuchadnezzar was the one that had just destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. This was Daniel in Babel after the Churban of the first Beis HaMikdash. So the Nebuchadnezzar was certainly talking about, or the vision was certainly talking about Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Babel. Nebuchadnezzar was killed, and his malchus was taken over by Paras. Right, we, you know, a little later on, you come across Achashverosh, who was king of Paras. So that's the second, that's widely accepted to be the second of the four Malchios. And the third is Yavon. Later on, during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, right, the Hanukkah story that's coming up, Bnei Yisrael fighting against Yavon. Yavon was a mighty empire under Alexander the Great. He conquered much of the world and established Greek influence and Greek culture, right, Hellenism, across much of the civilized world at that time. Those are the first three Malchiyos. Then the fourth, the standard interpretation, we'll start with this and we'll work backwards. The standard interpretation, and I say standard because it's based on Mamari Chazal. This is what, as the Rambam points out, when we're going to get into the Machlokes Rishonim about, but the Rambam points out that we have a Kabbalah from Chazal, so we're going to start with that. That the fourth Malchus is Rome. And the reason to, you know, that's very understood because the Churban of the second Beis HaMikdash was in the hands of Rome. So Bnei Yisrael, after they passed out of the Shlita of Yavon, they entered into the Shlita of Rome. Titus Aspasianus, they destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash. They took Bnei Yisrael away, they brought them into Gaulus. So they're in the Gaulus of Rome. And that's that would be interpreted as the fourth Malchus. So Babel, Paras, that's Persia, Yavon, that's Greece, and Roimi, or Rome, that would be our starting point, as that's the Pshat of the four Malchus. Along came the Ibn Ezra in the 1100s, and he has the Kasha. And his kasha was, where are the Muslims in this description of world history? How could you have a description of the great powers of world history that leaves out the Muslim Empire? To give a little bit of background, you had...
Who gave the description?
This kasha? This kasha is from Ibn Ezra.
And Ibn Ezra was asking on who?
How could you have... Well, if the Pesukim in Daniel is supposed to be a description of world history, a vision of world history, and we're interpreting it as Babel, Paras, Yavon, Roimi, so that means that the Muslim Empire is left out of that description. How could that be? So a little bit of the background, the historical background. Muhammad came along in the early 600s. In the Arabian Peninsula, in Arabia, right, the people there were considered, called Arabs, that's why it's called Arabia. Ties into yesterday's shir, of course, right? Yesterday we were talking about the camels of Arabia. And it was like most places in the world. It was, you know, the people there were, they were pagans, various idol worshippers. And Muhammad came along, he said he had a prophecy, and he, through his, I guess, charisma, he was an impressive person in some ways, he was a warrior also, which was always helpful, and he brought a lot of people under his sway, and he began his prophecy, his revelation, whatever, was in the year 613 of the Common Era. He died about 19 years later. By the time he died 19 years later, all of Arabia was under his control, more or less. And then, after he died, those that succeeded him decided that this new religion of ours is not meant to be a docile religion that just stays in one place and minds our own business and serves our God, but it's a religion of expansion, a religion of conquest, and so we have to expand outwards. And so they, from the peninsula, they first went north, which is very significant, Agav, in Jewish history, because what's directly north of Arabia, so if you think of the modern map, so the Arabian Peninsula is mostly Saudi Arabia, and if you go north, right, you can't go east or west or south, because it's water. The only place to go is north, and where's where do you get when you go north of there? Huh? No, you get in Iraq. You get into Iraq, which is, in the ancient world, that's what's called Bavel, which is where all the Yidden lived, not all Mamish, but the main center of Jewish, the Jewish people at that time, in the 600s, was in Bavel. And the Yidden in Bavel at that time were in a gefer l'chames. There was a war that had been going on for more than 100 years between two powers, and both of them hated the Jews, and the constant state of war is worse than everything. So, you know, between the fact that they were surrounded by enemies and that there was anarchy and war, it was a very big mess, and the Yidden were in a very desperate matzah. These two sides that had been fighting for, I think, more than 100 years already without any clear winner, in the year 633, the Muslims swept up out of the Arabian Peninsula, wiped away all of the two sides, the two factions that had been fighting in Bavel, and they conquered Bavel, and they established an Islamic Republic there, and then they continued north, east, west, in all directions, and over the next 100 years or so, 100 years, 120 years, they were expanding and expanding and expanding. And by the year approximately 750, they had conquered the whole, let's say, what we would call nowadays the Middle East, then all the way across the continent of Africa, not down south, but the northern part of Africa, that's what they call the Maghreb, that was entirely Muslim, and that's going west, and east, the whole area in the former Soviet Union that's called the stands, the Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and various other stands, and the other independent countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan, stand means land in Arabic. All of those are a part of what the Muslims conquered in the 600s and the 700s. So it was an area from east to west, I think about twice the size of the United States. It was a huge empire, and it was conquered very quickly, a tremendously successful empire. And the effect that they had on Bnei Israel in the immediate was a real Yeshua, because the Yidden in Bavel, like we just said, the Yidden in Bavel in the year 632 were really facing a very, very bleak outlook. The Muslims came, and they were like liberators, because it ended the state of war, it drove away the enemies, and under the Muslims, the Yidden flourished. They allowed the yeshivas, Surah Pumbedisa, to be open and to run, openly. They allowed the yeshivas to have Ga'inim, and they allowed there to be a Reish Galusa. Back to the glory days of the Amirayim. And so the Yidden in Bavel had it much better, and also as the Muslims were expanding very, very rapidly, so the Jews were traveling along with them, and whereas until then the Jews had really been concentrated in one place, for the vast majority of the Yidden were in Bavel, that which the Jewish world was able to start expanding was largely as a result of the Muslim expansion. As the Muslims moved, especially westward, the Jews moved with them and established communities along North Africa and into Spain, and the Muslims crossed over the Mediterranean and into Spain. They conquered that also. The Jews moved there again with the Muslims, and they had the protection under the Muslims.
The Muslims were tolerant of the Jews?
Right, yes. The Muslims were...
They didn't try to convert everybody?
Not yet, not at this point.
They were just trying to conquer people?
Right, they were trying to conquer the people that controlled those lands. That was never the Jews. The Jews didn't control anything. The populations that lived under them, they had a rule called the Dhimmi rule, or the Dhimmi system. Dhimmi meant the second-class citizens. And that was their designation for non-Muslims living in Muslim countries. And basically the rule was that, you know, certainly it wasn't democratic. It was no, you know, freedom of religion and all men are created equal. Muslims are the first class citizens and the dhimmis are the second class citizens. But there was a place in society for dhimmis. They had to pay extra taxes. They were excluded from certain privileges. But within those rules, they were allowed to flourish. And then, locally, in different places and different times, you had some people that, you know, some rulers that interpreted the dhimmi laws more strictly and some that interpreted it less strictly. In Spain, it was very lenient, and in Spain, that's what people call the golden age of Spanish Jewry. In Spain, you had Jews that were rising up to the highest levels of society in the 800s, 900s, 1000s. The Muslims in Spain really felt like the Jews controlled the world. You had people like Shmuel HaNagid, or Chizda Ibn Shapruot, that were really the most powerful people in the country. They were the top advisors to the king, and they controlled a lot of the government. But even elsewhere, you didn't have it quite to that extent, but the Jews, for the most part, had it pretty good under the Muslims.
Spain was conquered by the Islam?
Muslims, yes.
This is by the Spanish Inquisition.
That was Christian, right? Most people, right, if you know one thing about the history of Jews in Spain, of course you know about the Inquisition, the expulsion. That was the Christians. Spain switched back. You see, with the Muslims, they were in that century or so, they were conquering, and for the most part, it didn't bother the Christians so much. You know, even though some of the stuff that they're taking away from the Christians. Okay, but, you know, that was Muslim territory, this was Christian territory. When they crossed the sea, and they came into Spain, now Spain is part of Europe, that was a big pachampanim to the Christians, because Europe is a Christian continent. This is our territory. So, you know, it's the fact that they have all this territory elsewhere, and they have the Holy Land, that's all bad, but that's, we call in Yiddish, a halbitzara. But the fact that they conquered Spain, which is part of the Christian continent, that was always considered a particularly offensive thing, particularly humiliating for the Christian world. So already back in the 700s, the leaders of Christianity declared what they called the Reconquista, their holy war of reconquest to take back Spain. From the 700s to the 1400s, it was about a 700-year war. Not that every day they were fighting the war, but it was a goal that was alive for around 700 years. And, you know, there were some times that it was, you know, sort of on the back burner, and sometimes that it was more prominent. But they were trying and wanting all that time. But nevertheless, in the period that we're talking about, it was definitely a Muslim country. The turning point came in the 1200s. I think in the year 1212, there was this major battle where the Christians retook most of Spain. So that begins the era that you're familiar with when you learn about, you know, the Jews living in Spain under the Christians. That's in the 1200s, 1300s, and 1400s. The final step of the Reconquista happened in 1492. There was the southern tip of Spain had remained Muslim for those last 200 and some odd years. After the Christians conquered everything else, just Granada remained Muslim. And then in 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella reconquered Granada, and that completed this 700-year project of the Reconquista. And then they were so happy, they were so excited, they accomplished that goal, so they celebrated by expelling the Jews immediately. That was from the battle site of that last battle where they signed the surrender, where the Muslims signed the surrender in Granada, that's when they wrote the Edict of Expulsion.
They said all Jews have to leave?
Yeah.
And when was the Inquisition?
In the Inquisition, if we move backwards a little bit, 100 years earlier in 1391, there was a wave of violence in the whole Spain against the Jews. A certain priest, Ferran Martinez, was going around firing up the crowd with very violent rhetoric, and Jews were being killed left and right, and pressured, you know, with this violence, pressured to convert. And so it was a very, very terrible year. It was really the first time in history, you know, there were many times in history that the Christians were pressuring the Jews to convert, and you... until that point, it had been happening predominantly in Ashkenaz, you know, in Germany, in France, this was happening on a regular basis, and the Jews were always being Moser Nefesh on a regular basis. The Jews gave up their lives, L'Kiddush Hashem, you know, starting, let's say, in Shnas Tatnu, by the First Crusade, that's 1096, and then after that, regularly, very regularly in Ashkenaz, there were terrible massacres, pogroms, blood libels, various things, and the Jews would be Moser Nefesh L'Kiddush Hashem. But when it happened in Spain in 1391, it came out very different. There was tremendous pressure on the Jews to convert, and according to the numbers that some historians estimate, there were about 50,000 Yidden that were killed that year, and 200,000 that converted. So for the first time, the Jews, for the most part, were not being Moser Nefesh. It was a different population, and they reacted very differently, and they converted. Now what that did, so... Okay, there's a lot of things going on here. But what that did politically for Spain, at first, they were overjoyed. Wow, you know, this is the biggest success in the history of the Catholic Church. We've always been trying to win over the Jews. And up north, in Germany and France, they never got their act together. And we're so good at it. We converted 200,000 Jews in one summer. But then they quickly realized that they had a disaster on their hands, because now you had, so this population, they converted. So officially they were Christian. They're not allowed to practice Judaism. If they practice Judaism, they're breaking the law, they could get thrown in jail, or worse. They're officially Christian. But they're not really, some of them went the whole way. You know, some of them embraced Christianity. But many of them, you know, they were living as Jews. They had a gun to their head. They said, okay, I'll be a Christian. They baptized, and they were Christian, but they didn't believe in Christianity, they didn't feel like Christians, so they were practicing their Judaism secretly, but they were legally Christian, which means that all rights that Jews were excluded from were open to them. They were allowed to be in the military, in the universities, in government positions, and so now they were Christians, but they had Jewish brains, and right, which the other people and the other Christians in Spain didn't. That was a very significant difference. Within about 50 years, they rose up to the top. These, what they called the new Christians, rose up to the top of so many different areas of Christian, of Spanish society, the military, the universities, the economy. You had the richest, the most powerful people in Spain from these new Christian families, which were known to be fakers. So then they had a problem, that we have to root out the fakers from the new Christians, from the conversos. So then they brought in an inquisition. They established the Inquisition. The Inquisition is a body within the church with police powers that's able to conduct investigations and punish people that are committing crimes against the church. The Inquisition, contrary to what you probably think from, you know, from the references you've heard growing up, the Inquisition never really bothered a Jew. Officially, I mean, the Inquisition doesn't have jurisdiction over the Jews. It's a church office, and it's supposed to keep, you know, maintain adherence to the law within the church. So their jurisdiction was over the new Christians, some of whom were secret Jews, and so they got established, I think, around the year 1480. That's the Spanish Inquisition. Then in 1492, after the Muslims conquered Granada, the Christians, Ferdinand and Isabella, conquered Granada, the whole Spain was now Christian. So then they turned their attention to the Jews, and they realized that we're trying to get to take care of the new Christians. This is the explanation that they wrote in their Edict of Expulsion, that we're trying to get a handle on the Christian population and root out the Muranos, that's what they called the secret Jews among the new Christian population. But as long as there's a Jewish population in Spain, we're never going to be able to do that, because the secret Jews get their chizuk from the real Jews. So we have to get rid of all the real Jews. So then they gave 3 months' time. By Tisha B'Av of that year, of 1492, all the Jews had to be out of Spain, which means that anybody that was left behind, so Manushach, who are you? If you're Jewish, then you should be executed for being in violation of the Edict of Expulsion. If you're not Jewish, so if you're staying behind, that means that you're considering yourself Christian. If you're considering yourself Christian, then you're under the jurisdiction of the Inquisition, and then if you get caught keeping any of the mitzvahs, you can be punished by the Inquisition. That's the story of how the... Okay, that's some of the background that sort of fills in the gaps on what you're familiar with. But coming back to the Ibn Ezra, The Ibn Ezra is before any of this. The Ibn Ezra is before the reconquest, and he lived in Spain originally, and Spain was under Muslim control. But whereas I was just describing to you before how Muslim control was such a great thing for the Jews did so much better under the Muslims than under the Christians, and they were flourishing in Muslim land. But that all changed right before, like a dur before the Ibn Ezra. Maybe it was even in the Ibn Ezra's childhood. I don't really know what year he was born. But in the 1130s, or so, there was a guy by the name of Ibn Tumart, who started a new movement called the Almohads, which is very, very similar to a movement from today, the 21st century, that you're familiar with. He was objecting to the way the Muslim governments in his time were not sufficiently strict and not sufficiently careful in upholding the Quran. He objected to the fact that women walked around not fully covered. He objected to the fact that that people were drinking wine and not fasting properly during Ramadan. He also objected to the fact that the Dhimmi laws were not being enforced as stringently as they should be. With the emphasis being on the keeping them in their place, and not, you know, they were putting too much emphasis on the tolerating them. And Ibn Tumart felt that there has to be more emphasis on the making sure they don't have too much shlita like they did in Spain. He gathered an army around him. He conquered all of the governments in North Africa, conquered that whole area. And then in 1148, he crossed the Straits of Gibraltar into Spain, and he conquered all of southern Spain. So this southern Spain, which had this golden age in which the Jews were flourishing and they had such freedom and liberties, all that came crashing to a halt. Under the Almohads, it was achas tasei lahamis. They did not allow Jews under any circumstances to remain as Jews in their lands. Things changed overnight in Spain from being really great to terrible, and that's the Spain that Ibn Ezra knew. Ibn Ezra was a big traveler. He didn't only live in Spain. He spent some of his time in Christian lands also, but he spent a good part of his life in Muslim lands, and it was, for him, it was a disaster. If I'm not mistaken, I read once that he had a son who fell into the hands of the Almohads and, under pain of death, converted to Islam, which was, of course, a source of terrible akas nefesh for Avraham Ibn Ezra. This was the Muslim world that he experienced. Okay, that's the background. We went a little bit off topic in response to your questions, but yeah, I'll take another one.
No question, it's very off topic, but are you allowed to convert to Islam? Because it's not really idol worship.
It's a good ara. There's if I'm not mistaken, the Ritva in Psachim says Befeirish that it's Yehar Gval Yavar. I would assume that's the Pashtus. Even without that Ritva, even though you're right, it's a good ha'ar. It's not really idol worship. The Rambam makes this distinction, like Abi Sam Halachas, like Abi Yayin Nesach. The Rambam makes a distinction between Christianity and Islam. He says that Islam is not real idol worship. But what the Ritva says is that even though it isn't really idol worship, so particular acts of Islam are not Avodah Zarah, but it's still a different religion. So when we talk about the Yehar Gval Yavar, that a person has to be Meisir Nefesh to... The Chazal called Meisir Nefesh not to be Oyver Avodah Zarah, but he says that belonging to a different religion, that means you have to be a Jew and believe what a Jew believes. So to accept the prophecies of Muhammad, even if there's nothing there no specific thing there that really qualifies as Avodah Zarah, because they worship the same God that we worship, but you're switching religions. So that's considered Yehar Gval Yavar. In the Rambam, there is a diuk in the Rambam. The Rambam holds that way also. But I guess the Shaila is a legitimate Shaila. I'm not certain that there's no one that would say the opposite, but those are the answers that I know. So this is the background, again, of where Islam came from, how mighty and powerful it became, and how it changed over time, and what was like in the times of the Ibn Ezra. The Ben Ezra asks the Kasha. They control such a large part of the world. They're such a mighty empire. They've been around. Ben Ezra is writing in the 1100s, so they're already 500 years old. How many empires in world history? The Greek Empire didn't last for that long and didn't control that much territory. Certainly the Babylonian Empire didn't. Why shouldn't the Malchus Yishmael count as one of the Malchios? If Yiddishkeit has a list, has a collection of the Arba Malchios, how could it leave out the Malchus of Yishmael? That was Ibn Ezra's kasha. And so what Ibn Ezra did was, he said that the way everyone's been counting until now is wrong. Even though he said, I'm not going to delete anything that we've been including, where, you know, everybody includes Rome, can include Rome. But remember what the third one was. The third one was Yavon, Greece. Rome and Greece should be counted as one. Because Rome sort of grew out of the Malchus of Yavon. You know, in the history of it, you know, they have some of the same characters in both of their histories, some of the same culture. Certainly the Roman Empire followed a lot of Greek mythology. And he points out that even in Chazal, you see this connection. Chazal talk about, the Chazal has this expression, Italia shel Yavon. They talk about, well, they tell a story about how on the day that Shlomo Melech married Bas Paris, and the Malach Gabriel came and he planted a staff in the Mediterranean Sea, and out of that grew Italia shel Yavon. Just think of the phrase, Italia, that's Italy, that's Rome, right? If anything's Rome, Rome is situated in Italy. The center of the Roman Empire was in Italy, and it's called Italia shel Yavon. So that means that we should view Italia, or Rome, as a subset, as a subdivision within Yavon, Greece. So that's all the third Malchus. When Titus and Aspasianus came and they destroyed the second Beis Hamikdash under the flag of the Roman Empire, that's all part of, in terms of Daniel's vision, that's all part of the third Malchus. And then, six centuries later, when Muhammad established his religion, and his followers came and they conquered such a large part of the world, that established the fourth Malchus. That's the Shita of the Ben Ezra. The Ramban argues against him. The Ramban, it's in a few places, but the one that's in his Pirush al Torah is found at the end of Parshas Pinchas. It's interesting, a few weeks ago, somebody came over to me and he asked me, where's the Ramban that talks about the fourth Chaya in the Nevuas and Daniel, whether it's Yishmael or Rome? I said, I think it's the end of Parshas Pinchas. He said, I was just looking there, it's not there. I said, let me take a look, I think that's where it is. He brought me a Chumash, and I turned to the end of Parshas Pinchas. I turned one way, turned the other way, I couldn't find it. I said, okay, I don't know, I'll get back to you. It turns out that it is over there, it's in the end of Parshas Pinchas, but it's not in the Chumashim. Because this piece was taken out when they printed the Chumashim. So, in the Mekoros Gedolos Chumashim, which were originally, the first Mekoros Gedolos Chumash was published in Italy in the 1500s under Christian supervision and Christian editing, censoring. So they took out this piece where the Ramban talks about identifying the fourth Chaya of the Arba Chayos. So it was a little surprising to me that even though we were looking in a new Mekoros Gedolos Chumash, it wasn't the art scroll, I don't know what's there, but it was the Hamar Mekoros Gedolos. Now this is printed in the 21st century in Yerushalayim, but nevertheless, it's still not there. In the Mekoros Gedolos Chumashim, it's not there. But if you look in other editions of the Ramban, it is there. So the Ramban is at the end of Parshas Pinchas. He also writes about it in some other places in some of his more obscure Svarim. But what he says, he brings down this Ibn Ezra, and he argues against him. He has a few points that he makes in his rebuttal. One point that he says, just in three words, he means to be alluding though. He says that the Ibn Ezra included Malchus Yishmael. I think his lashon was that ha'isa imasa mutelas alav. He means to be suggesting, I think, that Ibn Ezra was too much influenced by his own life story. And, you know, his life was so impacted, again, we mentioned before what happened with his son, was so severely impacted by the harshness of the Malchus Yishmael in his time. The Ramban felt that maybe influenced him in his interpretation of the Nebuah of Daniel. Okay, that's one time that he makes. And he says that it really should not be up for consideration because there's Gemara, there's Mamari Chazal, and he writes, you know, a lashon that after he goes through many arguments in proving his point and explaining why he's right and Ibn Ezra is wrong, at the end he writes that Kabbalosam MS, that, you know, our Maser from Chazal is trustworthy. So we don't have to, you know, aside from anything else, we have a Maser from Chazal. But then, as far as the actual debate, he says, the big mistake that Ben Ezra was making was that he was thinking that Daniel meant to be listing the great dynasties in world history. He says, these are not the great dynasties in world history. What about Hoidu and Kush and Tartar? He says, these are other Malchiyos of his time that were considered very mighty. I think when he writes Tartar, what he's referring to is the Mongolians that came. It's sort of a reference to China. You know, that's what we would think of as the one of the greatest dynasties in world history. Tartar, I think, is that part of the Chinese Empire that ended up invading Europe. So it's a reference to China. How you do is India. These are great dynasties. Some of them conquered more territory and lasted for more time than the Malchus in Daniel. But that has nothing to do with it. The Nebuah in Daniel is not about world history. It's about Jewish history. And it means to be describing from when Bnei Yisrael had their own Malchus, right? Shlomo HaMelech and his offspring, they ruled over Klal Yisrael. And that was taken away from by Nebuchadnezzar. So Bavel took away the Malchus from Klal Yisrael. And then the Nebuah in Daniel meant to be describing how that then got passed from one hand to the next. Who took over that from Nebuchadnezzar? That was Paras. And then Yavon. And then the Chaya HaRavias. Who took over that Shlita over Klal Yisrael? So clearly he says that was Rome. That's who came in when Bnei Yisrael sort of got their act together. You know, they fought off the Greeks. The Hanukkah story, which was 250 years before the Churban Beis Hamikdash, Gematria Ner, by the way, that's right. The Chanukah Nes lasted 250 years. The Gematria Ner, and then they who did they fall to next? Rome. So Rome is the Chaya HaRavias. It's not about how many territories they conquered and how many centuries they lasted. It's about who took over Bnei Yisrael after the Chaya HaShlishis. So that's clearly Rome. Yishmael came along centuries later, in the 600s, 7th century, Yishmael came along, but they came along in Arabia, at a time that Bnei Yisrael were already in Galus. Some of the Eden lived nearby in Babel, others lived elsewhere, but their rise to power was not a hemshuch of the story of who took over the Gullus of Bnei Yisrael. So therefore he says that it's not Yishmael, we have to stick with the old version, which is what Chazal say, that it's Edom. Edom is Rome. Right, that connection, by the way, right? Edom is Esav. Right? Like in this week's parasha, Al Kain Karash my Edom, because he sold the Bechara for the red lentils. At the end of Parshas Vayishlach, when it's going through the Alufei Esav, right? There's many, many Alufim over there. The last pasuk, Aluf Magdil Aluf Aram, Rashi says, Magdil Hu Roimi. Rashi quoting Medrash. So Chazal connects Edom with Rome, and that's the Malchus HaRavias. Now, the Ramban doesn't fully explain, but others pick up the story here. If the Malchus HaRavias is Edom, or Rome, so then the problem is, you come back to La'oim la'oim yamatz, right? That it's supposed to be the story of the whole future of Jewish history. But the Roman Empire is gone. So, and we weren't redeemed yet. Our Mashiach is supposed to come as a victory over the Chaya Haravias. And that's one of the rayas, rather, that it's supposed to be Edom. Look, it says Esav, it doesn't say Yishmael. That's one of the rayas of the Ramban against Ibn Ezra. But okay, but if that's supposed to happen with Asalavai, so, but isn't Esav out of the picture? Esav is Edom. Edom is Raimi. Fine, but where's Raimi? Raimi is a, you know, an insignificant, obscure city. It's not a malchus that's shaled over the world anymore. So what some of the Rishonim say, the Ramban, I think, is going with this also, but I don't know if he ever articulates it quite so explicitly, is that what we see nowadays, that he said that the Christian world, Christianity, is considered a hemshech of Rome. Because the Roman Empire, B'seif Yamav, converted to Christianity. That was under the Emperor Constantine in the 4th century. He became Christian. He converted the empire after 300 years of the Romans crucifying the Christians whenever they can get their hands on them. Eventually, the Romans became Christian. And so in the 4th century, the Roman Empire became Christian. And the Roman Empire controlled such a large part of the world. That's what made Christianity the dominant religion in the world. So now, even though the Roman Empire has fallen, and Christianity is not necessarily so messianic, even though the truth is, it is that also, right? The Christian world still is centered in Rome. That's where the Pope is situated. The Vatican is in Rome. But the power in the world doesn't really come from Rome. But all the countries that we think of as being the Western countries, the United States of America, the Ramban in his time, we would be talking about the European countries, the European powers, which are the main gevura in the world, were all Christian. And as such, they were the heirs to the Roman Empire. So we could trace a line, Esav hu Edom aluf magdiel, Roimi Christianity. So that's still here nowadays. And in that sense, you have the L'Oim Yamatz, that the Chaya Haravias in its present incarnation is the Christian world. That's the Ramban's Mahalach. Yeah, just very briefly, the Rambam gets in on it also. The Rambam has a little bit of an in-between shita. The Rambam, of course, is before the Ramban. But again, the Ramban, I'm calling it the Ramban, but the Ramban is not really a chiddush. The Ramban is just upholding what Chazal said. So the idea that the Chaya Haravias is Edoim is an old idea. The Rambam, in his Igeres Taimon, he talks about this question, and he has a shita which is a little bit of a compromise between the two shitas that we've been talking about. He says that the Chaya Haravias is a combination of the two. He points out that certain psukim in Daniel that seem to talk about a Chaya Haravias and then a Keren, a horn that grows out of that Chaya Haravias, which grows into its own monster. So there's sort of room for two entities within the Chaya Haravias based on those psukim. And he says that oversized horn is the Meshuggah. That's his name for Muhammad. Rambam in a few places refers to Muhammad as HaMeshuggah. And he says that Keren in Daniel is referring to HaMeshuggah. He writes very interestingly, there's a parak in Tehillim where David Melech, it's there's Tehillim here? No. Where David Melech is, it's the first, I think it's the first Shir HaMelech. It's parak Kuf Chaf. How does it start? Karasi El Hashem Batzarasa Li Bayanini. I called out in my, you have it there? Tehillim Kuf Chaf? Okay.
Which one?
Kufchav, 120. So it's a nevuah. David Melech is talking about a time that's a very bitter time in Jewish history. Karasa Lashem Batzarasa Li Vayaneni. And then he complains about the nations with their svas sheker lashen remia, their lips of falsehood and tongue of trickery. Thank you. Shir Malach Hashem, Batzarasa Li Karasi Vayaneni. in my distress, I called Hashem and he answered me, Hashem atzilu nafshi misfas shekem milashen remia. And then, okay, a couple of seconds later, oyo li kigarti meshech shachanti im ohalei kedar. Woe is me that I've dwelt for so long among the tents of Kedar. So the Rambam says, you know what that pasuk is referring to? He says that this is the David Melech speaking b'nevuah about the time that Bnei Yisrael are destined to be living among the... Who's Kedar, by the way? Anybody recognize the name Kedar?
I think that
could very well be. But we just had it in Parashat Shavuah last week. He was one of the sons of Ishmael. And the Rambam writes that according to the Muslim genealogies, the Meshuga, he says, is descended from Kedar. The line that they claim for Muhammad being a descendant of Ishmael is through Kedar. So he says that David HaMelech over here was having a nevuah, a Ruach HaKodesh, about the time that Bnei Yisrael will be living among the Muslims. Disappeared. I need your password. Thank you. It says, "Ayali ki garti mesher shachanti mahale kedar, among the tents of Kedar. Woe is me that I dwelt for so long." And listen to how he describes them. Rabbas shachna li nafshi im seinei shalom. Too long have I dwelt among seinei shalom, those that hate peace. Ani shalom v'chi adaber himol amalchama. I am for peace, and when I speak, they are for war. The Rambam says this parak is a description of the time the Bnei Yisrael have to have dealings with the Muslims. It's a fascinating Rambam. This reference, this, you know, that Shalom and Muhammad, Sayyidina Shalom. He says that this parak is all about the Muslims. But he says, with Sengel and Yanenu, is that he has this in between shita that the Chaya Haraviyas is the combination of Ishmael and Edom. So we have three shittas in Mishnah, and the Ben Ezra, the Ramban, and then the Rambam, which is a little bit syrup of the two. There's an original approach in the Maral, which has fascinating implications. I guess we took so much time on whatever. I mean, I guess it was all kedai, and hopefully it was gishmak. But we're not going to this some things that I wanted to talk about Arichas and the Maral. But al kaparim, the Maral's Eitzah, his solution to the Kasha, the Ibn Ezra's Kasha. How could it be that Ishmael is not on the list? Which again, the Ramban dismissed it. He said, it's not a Kasha. It doesn't bother me at all. Ishmael doesn't belong on this list. The Maral takes the Kasha, and he says that the Teretz is that he is on the list. He's hiding there in plain sight. You just didn't see him. How did we identify the first three Chayos? Bavel, Paras, Yavon. Zok the Maral, Paras, the Bnei Ishmael of today could be identified with Paras. Even though he says, really, they're not one and the same, because Persia is a separate Malchus from the Bnei Ishmael, from the Muslims. The Muslims originate really in Arabia. They were Arabs, and Arabs are ethnically a different clan, a different group than Persians. But he says he points to a Gemara, and I had wanted to do this Gemara somewhat by Arichas. I'm just going to very briefly read to you. I mean, a copy that was going to hand it out, but we just have a few minutes. Very briefly read to you the Gemara of Avodah Zarah, Daf Beis Amud Beis. It talks about how Allah said, "Love HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be having a debate with various Umayyad Ha'ilam, and it's going to say over there that he's going to tell the Romans, what did you ever do for the world?" And they're going to say, "What did we do? We made many markets. Harbi Merchat Sa'isasinu. We made many bathhouses. Harbi Kesef Azav Yerbinu. We amassed great wealth." And then they're going to add, "Bukulam Layasinu El Bashul Yisrael. And we did it all for the Yidden Kadesh Yitzaskuva Torah, so they should be able to learn Torah." HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to tell them, "Shaitim Sheva Olam, it's not true, everything that you did, let's serach atzmachem asizim, we did it for your own good." And he says, you know, you were interested in pursuing your taivas and your wealth. Then it says, Rome is going to exit, Nichnas Amach Malchus Paras Achareha, and Persia is going to enter. And Hashem is going to tell them, "Bamaya Sakhtim, what did you ever do for the world?" And they're going to tell me, "Bainu Shalom, Harbi Gesharim Gesharnu, We made many bridges. Harbi Karachim Kavashnu. We conquered many cities. Harbi Melchamis Asinu. And we waged many wars. V'kulam layasinu ala b'shvil Yisrael k'dei she'ezaske b'teira. And it was all done so that Klai Yisrael could learn Teira. And Klai Yisrael was going to tell them, Shaitim Shabayilam. Over here it doesn't say Shaitim Shabayilam. But it says, Kol ma she'asitim u'zerach asmachem asitim. No, you did it all for your own good. Okay, that's the Gemara. Ayin Sham, there's more parts of that are interesting. But that's the main part of the Gemara. And the Maral says that what you see in that Gemara, from the fact that Rome gave their answer, and Paris gave their answer to this question of what did you do for the world, what that means is that these titles, Roimi, Paras, they represent more than just a country with its borders, but they represent a culture. What were you Isaac in? And people of a culture share a world value, share what they're Isaac in, what they view as their contributions to the world. And in that sense, considering that Paras, in later times, adopted the same religion, and religion is the biggest part of the culture, especially, you know, maybe not so much in modern times, but in the ancient world, the biggest factor or ingredient in a nation's culture is the religion. And Paras adopted the religion of the Arabs because they accepted Islam. Persia is a Muslim nation nowadays, and in the Maral's time, Persia was a Muslim nation. So even though there were different people, but you see from that Gemara and Avodah Zarah that the key is not so much the people, but meaning not so much their ethnicity, but their culture, and culturally they united with the Muslims. And so, more than 1,000 years, maybe 1,500 years, maybe less, 1,200 years maybe, after the Paras of Daniel's vision, Muhammad came and made a new religion, and they ended up conquering a large swath of the world. They were a Gevaldig Malchus, but it didn't need a new Chaya in the vision of Daniel, because it fit into one of the old ones, because Paras became united with Ishmael. That's the Maral's solution to that Gemara. To that question. So now there's really this four Mahalchim that we have about where's Ishmael. According to the Ramban, he doesn't belong. According to the Ben Ezra, he is the fourth Chaya. According to the Rambam, the fourth Chaya is a combination between Edom and Ishmael. And according to the Maral, Ishmael is actually part of Paras. There's one more interesting Gemara I want to mention. A new Medaf Yud. I have a Gemara. There's an Achalikas of the between Rav Yechanan and Rav. Amar Rav Chana, Rav Yechanan, Moshe Rav Yehuda, Rav Eloi. Asida Roimi Shetibel Biad Paras. Rav Yechanan said that in the Asid, right, that what the future holds of that, I guess he means at the end of days, that in the final round of world history, Rome is going to fall in the hands of Persia. Amar Rav, Asid Paras Shetibel Biad Roimi. No, Persia is going to fall into the hands of Rome. So there's a machlekes here in the Gemara, Rabbi Yechon and Rav, the Gedolei Amorayim, about Paras and Roimi, which one is going to fall into the hands of the other. Considering the Ramban that we learned and the Maral that we learned, these all have identities in the modern world. Paras means the Muslim world. Roimi means the Christian world. Or what is called sometimes, the Eastern world and the Western world. All right, you have, let's say, the United States and its allies. You have Iran. Of course, it's not just Iran, but they're maybe the most vocal, the most provocative among the Muslim nations. And some people get the feeling that there's some kind of a confrontation brewing at some point. There's a struggle in the world between Roimi and Paras. So the Gemara in Yumadaf Yud says it's a machlokes. So we don't have anything. We don't have anything definitive. But we have this vision of La'asid Lavai, a major confrontation between these two world powers that could be identified on our map today. Asida Roimi Shetibel Biad Paras. or I see the parsha will be agroimi. Okay, that's really, I guess, the end of the shir. There's a vart, if you want to stay another couple of minutes. There's a geshmak of vart from the Brisker Rav on the Gemara that I was mentioning before in Avodah Zarah, where each one they come and they say, we did this, we did that, and we did the other thing. And kulam lo yasinu el bishvil Yisrael sheis asku b'tayra. And Hashem Baruch Hu says to them, "Shaitim shav oilam." The lashon is there in the first round when he's talking to the Romans. "Shaitim shav oilam, kol hashasitim l'tzarech atzmachem asitim." So this Rav asked, "What were they thinking? They're standing before the Rabbeinu Shlaim at a time of, you know, where he's become revealed to the world. They know who they're dealing with, and they're making up such a ridiculous lie that yeah, when we were conquering these territories, when we were building these economies, it was all b'shvul she'isol she'isask b'tayra. And give me a break. Of course it's not true." So the Brisker Rav said, "No, it is true. It's true because HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the events of world history, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's goal was that Yisrael she'isask b'tayra, that Klal Yisrael should survive through the Galus, and they should thrive through the Galus, right? And that the Torah should stay alive. And he saw to it that when things got desperate in Bavel, the Muslims should come and conquer it, and that would, you know, and that conquest would enable Esek HaTorah to continue to flourish. He saw to it that when the Yidden needed a new place, the United States of America should have this booming economy, where Yidden are going to be able to come and thrive and build yeshivas and countless other examples in world history. HaKadosh Baruch Hu from behind the scenes was seeing to it that Paras, that Roimi, should do these things that they should ask of a Torah. Now, of course, that wasn't their kavana, but that's the real reason why it happened. And La'asad Lavai, when, right, Krevi Shuasi Lavai Vitzid Kasili Higalais, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu Tzedakah with Chazal becomes Nizgala, and then it turns out, everybody looks back at these events of world history and realizes, oh, you know why that happened? B'shvil Yisrael Kadei She'es Asku B'Torah. So then the Goyim are going to come and they're going to say, so look, don't we get some credit for that? We conquered this. Okay, we did it for whatever reasons we were doing it, but the reason why you allowed us to conquer this part of the world, the reason why you allowed us to build this economy is B'shvil Yisrael She'es Asku B'Torah, and look how much Torah flourished under our Malchus, don't we get any credit for that? To which HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered, unfortunately not. No, if you would have accepted the original role of Rav Yavoid Sayer and you would have worked towards that consciously, then you'd get credit. But you rejected it, and so it all ended up happening anyway, but without your, you know, it ended up happening Bal Karchach instead of Mirzoincha. So you didn't prevent anything from happening, you just prevented yourselves from getting the credit for it. Because now that it happened, yes, through you, but not consciously, only unconsciously and Bal Karchach, so you lost your chance to get the credit for it. That's how the Brisker Rav explains that tomorrow. All right.